You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Judith Jones began her publishing career at Doubleday in Paris and then moved to Knopf, where she has worked for 52 years now, currently as a senior editor and vice president. Over that time, she has introduced some of the most enduring culinary and literary authors of our age, including a few other publishers had passed on, like Anne Frank, James Beard, Jacques Pepin, and Julia Child. She's also written a number of books of her own. In her latest, The Pleasures of Cooking for One, Miss Jones sets out to prove that living alone does not mean you have to subsist on frozen dinners. In fact, she claims her recipes and tips will make cooking a joyful experience for the solitary chef. It's published by Knopf, of course, and it brings Judith Jones to our show. Hi. Didn't your late husband write cookbooks? Did he do a lot of the cooking?
Yes, he did. He did. He was sort of wrote books about social history, and more began to discover that we don't use food as a way of understanding our country, our people, the past and the present. And so he wrote a wonderful book years ago on American food, what he called the gastronomic story. It was kind of before its time because it was just probably the end of the 60s, and then there was that explosion of interest in food, which we really can thank Julia Child for.
And you. and a few other people.
Yeah.
Well, you said that after Evan died, you worried that you would never enjoy sitting down for a nice meal that you'd cooked for yourself.
Yeah. I really was almost afraid of it because it was something that had a pleasure we had shared. And I found I was wrong, that I just love coming home at the end of the day. I start thinking in the day afternoon, what am I making tonight? And salivating a bit and maybe picking up something at a vegetable stand that I forgot. And you walk into an empty house, and what could make it more alive than getting cooking smells going, the garlic sizzling and the splashing in the wine. And then you set a nice table, and I always light some candles and turn on some music. It's, to me, the happiest moment of the day.
Well, a lot of people feel that it's not worth the time and effort to cook for just one person. They're happy to cook when guests come over, but the rest of the time they buy prepared foods at places like Trader Joe's.
Yeah. Well, I think they're wrong because, number one, it's very relaxing, very focused, and you try something on yourself so that it's creative, you can experiment. You only have yourself to please. If it's no good, you eat it anyway. Learn from it.
And they always say that you are the best cook for yourself because you know what you like.
You do. And that's a lot of fun. It's, you know, you don't bother to put the salt in a teaspoon and scrape it to make it level. You just put a little in your hand and sprinkle it in and taste. Taste, that's the most important thing.
Well, you light some candles, so that means, unlike a lot of people, you don't watch TV while you're eating either.
Nope, I don't.
Did you design these recipes to be fast and easy, the ones that you have in this book?
That isn't what the emphasis is. They are efficient in the sense that you use something two or three times. And I call it second round, third round, not leftovers, because I recreate it in the sense of giving it different flavors. I might make a Chinese stir fry out of some leftover pork. I might make a little wonderful sauce for the pasta out of some leftover beef bourguignon. So I literally plan to give that dish two or three lives.
And you say in the book that your New England thriftiness affects your cooking style. You don't want to see any of those things go to waste.
I don't want it to go to waste. I'll scrape the last little bit of pan sauce and put it in a little jar because it'll be good in the soup.
I was pleased when I read what you do with leftover mushrooms and some other things, because throughout this past year I have been putting all of the little bits of the mushroom that I cut off and the leaves from celery and whatever else, all of the little stuff that didn't make it into the food, I've been putting them in a bag and put it into the freezer. And I just made myself a stock. And that's the sort of thing that you're suggesting here as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the great Jacques Pepin, I mean, the French are naturally thrifty. When he was working with Julia on her show, he was kind of offended that so much stuff was being thrown out. And he said, in my kitchen, I will put it into a milk carton, freeze it, and then when I want to make a stock, just like you, dump it all in.
What about when cheese develops a mold on the outside? Do you throw it away?
Of course not. I scrape the mold off and eat it. I mean, cheese is a fermented product. It's supposed to have mold.
And you also say that if you got a lot of milk in the house, you bought a half gallon and you're not going to use it all before it spoils, make yogurt?
Make yogurt, yep. But I really feel that we should, as consumers, rise up and protest what the supermarket makes us buy. Because it's very, this was one experience I had when I was started shopping for one. I felt humiliated. I would have to go up to the fish counter or the meat counter and beg them to give me just half of it. And you were sort of scorned. It's not part of our world.
Because the packages of meat and fish are all fairly large.
Yeah, exactly. And why should you spend $1.99 on a bunch of parsley that's a bouquet that would last 2 weeks? You don't need that much. So you give up buying it.
And you got me thinking, how many Americans do live alone and only need single-size portions?
Yeah. I tried to talk to some supermarket people and said, just think, if you had a sign on your window saying, we cater to singles too, you'd be flooded. But falls on deaf ears.
Well, they're into a quantity business as well as a, we hope, quality business.
They want us to waste.
My guest is Judith Jones, whose latest book is The Pleasures of Cooking for One. Why do you think so many of the people that you are credited with discovering had been rejected by other editors before you decided to champion them?
Well, I think that it's natural. We see loads and loads of proposals, and I think you kind of follow your own instinct. And in the case of Mastering the Art of French Cooking, I wanted a book that really taught me the fundamentals. Any art form, you learn the fundamentals, the techniques, before you take off and pirouette.
But what was the conventional wisdom then? A lot of savvy people turned this book down, turned down any number of other books like Diary of Anne Frank that have gone on to become classics.
Yeah. Well, in the case of Mastering the Art of French Cooking, it was a pretty sorry time. And I think that people felt no American woman is going to spend this much time cooking French. And we'd been given this barrage of propaganda from the food industry going back to the 19th century, telling us, oh, poor little woman, you don't want to demean yourself with dirty dishes and we'll take care of it. And so we fell for it. Well, I did. I wanted to learn to cook well. And I just figured that if I felt this way, there must be thousands of others. And the scene was changing, too, in that many people were starting to go to Europe. A young secretary could save her pennies and get her an economy flight and sit down at a real bistro in Paris and taste something that good. So they wanted to recreate it.
And you had lived in Paris.
Yeah, yeah.
In the film, Julia and Julia, a key point is when you decide to suggest a new title for the book. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it actually was that way. But Julia Child's title was not a selling title.
No, the original title was pretty bad. I've forgotten what it was. And we went through, I don't know how many. She was in Europe at the time. I mean, the movie took a little, but to make it a better movie. Actually, this was my correspondence, so I have a record of it all. We went back and forth. And finally I said, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, because it's a continuing process. And you know what Julia said? She said, I love the gerund. Now, who would even know what the gerund was today?
Did you cook from every manuscript that you've considered in the food books that you've worked on?
Well,
were you your own test kitchen, in effect?
Well, I'm not a test kitchen, but I am a tester to I want to get the feel, and I want to help that writer express things in his or her own voice. And so I do try some recipes. If they're going to use a writer, I'm often with them watching and asking questions so that I don't believe in recipes that are just dry formulas, like in a bowl, combine the first mixture with the second mixture. You know what I mean? You're looking, what's the first mixture? Oh, it's that milk you heated with a little salt. I mean, why not call things by their own name?
So you send manuscripts back to the writers and say,
oh, yes.
Can we fix up the way this recipe is written?
Yep, I tried.
Is there a real art to writing a good recipe?
Yes, there is. And I think it's using visceral language. And if you look at this whole story of Julia mastering, she was speaking in a way for three people, so it was a little more formal. But she still used wonderful words like plop it in a bowl instead of place it in a bowl.
I took all of this to heart. A friend asked me to help her write a cookbook some years back, and she was famous for her guacamole. Her name was Josefina Howard, Rosa Mexicana. Mm-hmm. And so when my recipe for guacamole went to four pages, they realized that I was not the right person for it. But I really got into that. I said, you know, you have to cut into the avocado so that you feel the tip of the knife tickling your palm.
I love that. And what that kind of writing does, it awakens one's senses. And you do cook with all your senses, the tickling, even the smell.
Since you've worked with so many different cookbooks and cookbook writers, Marion Cunningham, you've done Claudia Rodin, Lydia Bastanich, Marcella Hazan, Mada Jaffrey. Mm-hmm. Has that influenced the cooking that you do for yourself?
Oh, absolutely. I learn from everybody. I'm in a wonderful position to learn. And as Julia often said, we never stop learning, Judith.
Although the majority of the recipes in this book are classically French. There's a cream sauce, a cassoulet, a cheese souffle. Is that what you gravitate toward, French food?
I think that I am. Julia often said that French cooking was sort of the backbone of Western cooking and that it was codified and definite techniques. And I absorbed all those, so I think I cook mostly that way. But when I'm cooking with Mada Jaffrey, I'm cooking Indian with Claudia Rodin, I learn all sorts of tricks about Middle Eastern food and Sephardic cooking, and so it never stops.
Well, you had lived in France, as I said earlier. Mm-hmm. In fact, shared an apartment with the famous, notorious painter Balthus.
Mm-hmm.
Were you cooking then as well?
Well, I had a French beau who was a very good cook, and we decided, there were three of us living in this big apartment of the Countess Caetani, and she was off in Rome. And we decided, here we've got this free apartment. All we do need is to have free food. And what better than inviting people to some little soiree dinners, particularly Americans living in Paris who are lonely. But they pay for their dinner, which is what is known as a restaurant. Pretty soon we turned our apartment into this cozy little two or three times a week restaurant.
Was that legal? In New York, you would be arrested because you'd be selling food without a license.
Oh, we certainly would be. But, you know, the French food, anything for food. The Countess Caetani was notified by the concierge, and she came quickly back from Rome and delicately disposed of us.
You managed to smuggle back your heavy cast iron pot.
Yes.
What was the significance of that pot?
I think that you get very connected to your utensils when you buy good ones and they last a lifetime. And I think the reason I like this so much was that I learned how to brown meats and get that wonderful sort of crusty brownness that's what makes a sauce really rich and meaty tasting. And at the time, we were all using aluminum pots because the poor little woman couldn't lift a pot.
Were those kinds of pots even available in America at that time?
I don't think so. Hmm. You could still get a good cast iron skillet through the Vermont Country Store or something.
And now there's so much variety.
Yeah.
It depends on how much money you're willing to spend. Judith Jones, who's the winner of the James Beard Foundation Lifetime Achievement Award, her latest book, The Pleasures of Cooking for One, from Knopf. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Judith Jones, who's a senior editor and vice president at Alfred Knopf. She's the co-author with Evan Jones, her late husband, of three books, The Book of Bread, Knead It, Punch It, Bake It, and The Book of New England Cookery. She also collaborated with Angus Cameron on the L.L. Bean Game and Fish Cookbook. She has contributed to Vogue, Sever, Departures, and the late lamented Gourmet magazine. In 2006, she was awarded the James Beard Foundation Lifetime Achievement Award, and her latest book is called The Pleasures of Cooking for One. It is published by Knopf. And all we've been talking about is food, and most people know you as an outstanding cookbook editor, but you've edited some major literary works. Mm-hmm. Did you start out in cookbooks?
No, I started out, really Blanche Knopf hired me because she'd bought a number of French books after the war, and because I'd spent that time in Paris, I even sort of worked on the side as a literary agent. And so she needed somebody to work with the translations. So that was kind of my specialty.
How did you come across The Diary of Anne Frank?
Well, I was working then for Doubleday. They had just opened an office in Paris and sent an editor, scout, beautiful office on an apartment near the Bois de Boulogne. We used to have lunch there. It was really a lucky happenstance that I found that. And one day he went off to lunch with some publishers, and he said, he had a little pile of books and manuscripts and just said to reject them.
And he just told you to reject them?
Yeah, he'd glanced at them. And so I got to the Anne Frank book. It was an advanced copy of the French edition, hadn't come out yet, but I saw that face on the cover, and it just drew me in, and I read all afternoon and really lived that novel, that book, in a way that I can't remember. It was such an intense experience.
So you decided that it would be a good idea to publish it. Did your bosses at Doubleday think it was a good idea?
I mean, they did in New York, yeah. Ah.
No, they understood immediately.
They did. They did.
And you worked,
I had worked in New York in the office there, so at least I was known.
You worked directly with Otto Frank. He had certain concerns about the book, and the book has changed over the years, as we discussed recently with Francine Prose, because of all concerns that many people have had, including, as it turns out, Anne Frank herself.
Mm-hmm.
So were you concerned about changing a work of such significance?
Not at all. The only thing I remember distinctly was that Otto Frank, he came down, had lunch with us in Paris, and at one point he just said, I have to hold on to the dramatic rights because I couldn't bear to see somebody playing my Annie. That was really... And, of course, little by little, you know, the whole story was persuaded, And I hadn't even known that he had done some editing on the original manuscript. We just worked from the French book.
So you came to Knopf because of your familiarity with French literature, but you wound up working on John Updike's books. You edited all of his novels?
All but the first. The editor who brought him in was fired. there was a lot of
I hope not for bringing him in.
No, but and it was given to me partly because I'd been so enthusiastic about it, and I think Mr. Knopp thought, well, Mrs. Jones should be broadening her reach. And,
well, what do you do when John Updike gives you a manuscript? The man wrote like a dream. Mm-hmm. Do you say, John, I really think you should change this word?
A lot of people ask me what is the most important quality in an editor, and I often say diplomacy. You have to know your man. I knew that Updike had left Harper because somebody wanted to change it, and they were, you don't tell John Updike what to do. But you might, just in a gentle way, say, hey, I was sort of puzzled by, and then we get to talking, but he still does exactly what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's also a matter of saying, perhaps you haven't, this isn't clear enough, or maybe the book is too lopsided in this way. I don't mean just John Updike, but any writer of significance, because you've also worked with John Hersey, you've worked with Ann Tyler.
It's the degree with each one. Uh-huh. John Hersey, interestingly enough, really welcomed somebody who got deep into the novel and talked about its aims, and he loved it.
Mm-hmm. When did you start editing cookbooks? If I remember correctly, the first one was Elizabeth David's Italian Food, or at least the first one that you came across.
That's the first one I supposedly worked on. It had been bought by, I think it was Blanche Knopp when she was in London. And she didn't know anything about cooking and couldn't have cared less. So it was already a book. And the few suggestions I made to Elizabeth David were struck down with horror and cracks like, oh, those Americans, they have to have things so exact, for heaven's sake. And so I had very little to do with them.
Well, that whole exactitude thing you also have made fun of. You're caught in some kind of a bind when you do a cookbook in this country, aren't you? Because chefs, as you say, never really measure, oh, I'll put in a teaspoon of this or a tablespoon of that. They kind mm-hmm. of take a pinch or a couple of pinches. But in our cookbooks, it's always an exact amount, one cup plus 1/8.
Yes. Yeah, and it's a difficult situation because you're writing for complete neophytes, as you say, and you're writing for very sophisticated cooks. But there still are ways, and I think I go back to the voice. Sometimes you can remove something from the recipe itself and write a sidebar about the best way to prepare garlic, so that it doesn't take up a paragraph. And then, and if you already know it, then you skip it. But I do think that you want to know something about the technique, about how to correct, to learn from it. And that's what I encourage.
Well, what about this cookbook? How precise is it? Are you being a little more casual in some of the recipes?
I am trying to persuade people to get the feel more of what a teaspoon of salt is like in your hand. Then the hand tells you, and you don't have to go through all this fussy measurement. Because I think it makes you more creative, more comfortable in the kitchen. And if you say, hold back on the salt and then taste, you teach people how important that tasting is, and smelling. And so I've loosened up a lot. I feel that, particularly when you're alone, you can just enjoy that aspect of cooking.
Well, it's also just a matter of the ingredients. One head of broccoli is not the same as the next head of broccoli.
Of course it isn't. No.
And one might require more salt or mm-hmm. something else.
Yeah. And
you don't know until you're cooking it.
You don't.
Now, is editing a cookbook the same as editing a work of literature?
No, it is miles apart.
So you actually have to change your whole sensibility when you're working on one or the
other? I get much more involved in a hands-on way because I like to see that person cook. And particularly if they're going to hire a writer, I want to be there to see that they ask the right questions.
In this book, The Pleasures of Cooking for One, you include a recipe called a potato dish for Julia How did you come up with that recipe?
Well, I know people love stories and the sources. Where did this recipe come from? There's nothing all that new. But very often I would go up to Cambridge where the Childs lived, and we would work all day on a book and, you know, testing things and refining the writing. And Julia was a perfectionist.
Well, you have a reputation for being a bit of a perfectionist as well.
I guess so. But she was very special. She always wanted to get right to the root of it. So sometimes it would be 10 o'clock and we still hadn't had dinner. And Julia would say, enough, put away the books. And then she'd poke her nose in the refrigerator and say, I'll make this nice little steak. And Judith, why don't you make a potato dish? I remember this so clearly. So I made this little dish where you pile slices like scalloped potatoes right into a little heavy iron skillet. And for the fun of it, I smashed a clove of garlic with salt so it becomes a real paste. And I sort of smeared that on when the pan was half full and then put another layer and fried the bottom, turned it over, fried the other side.
It's like a tortilla, a Spanish tortilla.
Yeah, yeah. And but the secret ingredient was that little garlic he tastes in the middle. And Paul, her husband, said, this is really good. And then Julia tasted and said, something like, it certainly is. And I was in cook's heaven.
Because you had invented something, and that's part of the fun of cooking,
absolutely.
Isn't it?
Absolutely.
I remember Julia being here with Jacques Pepin, and I asked them which one was the more rigid traditionalist, and they both said Julia, definitely.
She, absolutely.
And Jacques was he was ready to do anything American.
Yeah. And when they worked together on that show, and that was what was so wonderful about it, and the book too, because we gave Julia's recipe and Jacques' recipe, and it showed you that nothing is ever cooked the same. It's in who's doing the cooking.
Now, Julia Child's book has gotten a lot of press lately because of the film, Julie and Julia. Were you involved at all in the film? Because
no.
There is somebody playing you.
Yeah. No, I wasn't really, except Nora Ephron did. She wanted it to be accurate and sometimes would ask me if Julie would use that expression or little details like that.
Well, in the movie, there's a scene where you're invited to Julie Powell's apartment for dinner, but you cancel at the last minute. Did that really happen?
That's a long story. they took some liberties. I was going to go and watch her cook and talk about the rights and various things. I hardly knew what a blog was. But after both Julie and I looked at her blog, Julia said, I don't think she's a serious cook. No.
And Julie Powell was very hurt by that.
Yeah. But you couldn't. I mean, the blog was full of four-letter words, and it just wasn't Julia's style.
On the other hand, it was saying the most exciting thing you can do is cook every recipe that Julia Child has written in this great book, which was honoring Julia Child. And I gather now you have your own blog, don't you?
Yes, I do. But
so you've
I'm
come
just
a long
getting
way.
My feet wet.
How often do you post?
I try to put up something about every couple of weeks.
And what do you write about?
Well, I wrote a little bit about the Julie and Julia thing. I wrote about pots and pans. The things that are sort of what makes your kitchen quiet and the pleasure. And then I've been growing grass-fed beef in northern Vermont, so I wrote some about that. Mm. And I had used all the pieces that we kept for private use, and I was down to the heart. And in my blog, I said, anybody got a recipe for the heart? Never got an answer.
Really?
that tells you about America.
Because brains have been part of American cuisine, at least out in the West.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But not beef heart.
Not beef heart so much, no. Guess not.
Do you think a new generation of cooks will embrace mastering the art of French cooking? Or are they buying the book because it seems so charming after they've seen the film?
I think that they're really taken with the idea that cooking can be fun and creative, and it just, Julia just exudes that pleasure in it. And I think if they give it a chance, they'll find that it's not demanding. It just gives you the fundamentals. You learn. And I don't understand why we think we can perform beautifully in any art without learning the basics.
Did any of the recipes have to be updated for the new edition?
Well, Julia updated all along. I mean, when new equipment came, when the first food processor started to be in everybody's home, she tried everything on it, and so she adjusted the recipes. But we haven't done anything since. I wouldn't do anything without Julia.
Well, she took out the asbestos gloves and things like that. She really was into... I mean, she changed. She changed her attitude about organic food, for example. But I remember she thought that that bread machines were good. You mm-hmm. just didn't want to cook. You didn't want to bake the whole bread. You wanted to use it for the first part. It cut out an awful lot of nasty busy work, she said.
I disagreed with her on that, and I argued with her. One of the great pleasures of making bread is kneading.
Uh-huh. Well, your late husband, wrote a whole book about bread and kneading it.
Yep, that we did together. Yep.
Uh-huh. You've said that Julia Child changed everything in terms of how Americans understand food and cooking. Everything, really? I mean, there were other people before her.
But we had been so repressed by a kind of Puritan attitude that cooking wasn't something you talked about, wasn't something that you spent time on. And I think that she sort of lifted that and made people enjoy the physical aspect of it. And to me, that was a huge change.
Well, how have cookbooks changed over the course of your career? I'm sure you get new ones all the time, but I'm sure you also look at what other people are publishing.
Well, in the 50s, I think that the scene was pretty sad, and it was really a low point gastronomically. And cookbooks were what I made up of what I call box top recipes. And
I remember when you used to get little recipes on matchbooks.
Yes, and the shorter the better, because then you could boast this book has 700 recipes.
But you had to use Del Monte tomato paste, I remember.
Yeah. And no instruction whatsoever, no substitutes, no. They weren't really talking very much to the housewife. I don't know who they were talking to.
Are you surprised by some of the things that have happened recently? The closing down of Gourmet magazine, the closing of Chanterelle, a restaurant that got 28 in the latest Zagat.
I didn't know Chanterelle had gone.
Yeah, they got 28 in the latest Zagat, but they closed for renovations and then realized that they just, they were a mom and pop operation. They couldn't keep it going.
That's a shame. Yeah. No, and I think Gourmet too. It's been with us for so long and reflected the change in American appetites, and I think it's served a real purpose.
But it's gone. Well, maybe others will fill the vacuum.
I think that more than anything, it's the fact that young people get their information on the internet, and if they have bought a chicken for the first time and they're going to go home and roast it, they just Google roast chicken and up come 20 recipes. They don't know who's writing them, which one is better than the other, probably take the quickest. But it's easy, and they don't have to use bookshelf space for yet another cookbook.
So what did you do with that beef heart that you had left over? Did you wind up preparing it?
I did, and I remembered a recipe that my husband had done on his daughter's 16th birthday. And it was called Love in Disguise, and it was a Welsh recipe. And you can guess what love was made with. The heart.
Uh-huh.
And I just remembered it, that you sliced into the lobes and made a dressing. So I made a dressing. This was beef heart, not veal. I thought it would take at least two hours. I think I cooked it almost 2.5. Very slowly, red wine.
It's a lot of muscle, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. But it all softened, and the stuffing sort of melded into that. I love that intense taste of some of the organ meats. It was very good. And people ate it who thought they were going to be sick at the idea of it.
Well, as you said earlier, Americans do have a problem with the idea of organ meats, although sweetbreads perhaps have become more appreciated in recent years.
Mm.
Some people eat tripe, but very little else.
Very little else.
Nobody wants to eat lungs.
Cheeks are suddenly becoming popular.
Are you going to cook something from this cookbook tonight?
Or
the next time you eat alone anyway?
Yeah. Oh, I do, and I'm constantly making new things. I had such a good time, though, because I gave myself a year, and I just, every night I was home, and I really tried to stay home to do it. I would experiment with things. If they didn't work, I threw them out, but no, it was great fun.
Judith Jones is senior editor and vice president at Alfred A. Knopf. And she's also a winner of the James Beard Foundation's Lifetime Achievement Award. Her latest book, not one that she's edited, because I guess you don't edit your own books, but you've edited so many books.
Yeah.
This one is The Pleasures of Cooking for One, and it is published by Knopf. And I want to thank you for being with us again.
Well, I enjoyed it very much.